Can meditation change your brain? A new study out of UMass Medical School and Massachusetts General Hospital has found that a type of meditation called mindfulness training actually increases the gray matter in brain cells. WFCR's Karen Brown spoke recently with study co-author James Carmody, a psychologist at UMass Worcester. He explained that mindfulness training is a relaxation method by which people watch their own thought processes unfold. It's thought to reduce stress and create a sense of well-being. He says this is the first research to show the direct impact of mindfulness on the brain structure.
We found that the changes occurred in the areas of the brain that are related to emotion regulation and also awareness. And these are consistent with other studies of meditation that have been cross-sectional studies. In other words, these were people who were just scanned at one particular point in time and compared with another group at one particular point in time. In this study, what we did was we scanned the same people twice. Before they began the training, and they had no previous experience of this kind of training, and then following 8 weeks of training.
Is there a practical benefit to these kinds of brain changes? Does it carry into other parts of one's life? Or are you basically just describing what happens to the brain?
Well, we're describing what happens to the brain, and we're also drawing attention to the fact that these changes that occur in the brain are associated with a form of mind training, mindfulness training, that is also associated with lasting increases in well-being and reductions in stress.
If people were already reporting that they felt more relaxed or peaceful after meditation or mindfulness training, why is it important to show that that corresponds to a change in the brain?
First of all, we're always curious. As scientists, we're always curious about what's going on inside the system with any particular change that people report. So, I mean, that's just driven by curiosity and interest. And sometimes that curiosity and interest pays off in ways that you really never expect. So that's one response to that. The other thing is that you never know which particular networks might be associated with other networks that have been shown related to some particular disease process. So you're always exploring, trying to make connections and see how one field of experience might relate to another.
Is this meant to be sort of an alternative to, say, antidepressants or talk therapy or more traditional ways that people think of as increasing well-being?
Well, that's interesting, you know, because especially in light of the more recent research that's come out looking at the placebo effect that is apparently associated with antidepressants in people with mild depression, in which cognitive behavioral therapy, for example, seems to be equally effective. So I guess it's all in that same sort of field in which we're sort of groping around here for ways in which we can be more effective in supporting people and being happier, if you like.
You know, one thing this got me thinking about is I've done a number of stories on sort of the flip side of this issue, which is when someone goes through severe trauma or stress, there's some evidence that their brain changes negatively. Do you see this as the same mechanisms at work, just in opposite ways?
That's also a very interesting question. So, for example, like increases in gray matter in the hippocampus, for example, have been found in association with mindfulness training. That's been a fairly consistent change. And that's one of the areas, for example, that studies have shown there's some atrophy associated with in case of post-traumatic stress disorders. So it's a very interesting question. You know, we need to study it further.
You know, in your study, were you able to tell whether everybody's brain is subject to these changes or whether it's just a certain type of person or a certain type of brain or somebody with a particular experience that maybe primed them to have these changes?
When we are recruiting patients for clinical trials of mindfulness training programs, we get a very high refusal rate. Something like, you know, 50% of the people who are potentially eligible don't want to participate. So this indicates that, like, they hear something about it and they say, well, no, that's not for me. I'm very interested in what are the characteristics of these people. I think that's really important information for us to gather. I don't know how we get it. But I think there is some sort of self-selection process that occurs, yes. Does that mean that other kinds of people would not benefit? No, it doesn't really. I mean, we can't make that leap until we have more information.
Do you have any predictions on how this might end up progressing, how this information might lead to unexpected results or information?
No, I don't at this point, except to say that if it helps people to realize that, in fact, their sense of well-being is to some measure within their control. They can exert some influence upon the way in which they experience their life. This doesn't exclude people's external circumstances, which are very difficult and challenging, obviously, for a lot of people, especially now. But there are ways of educating ourselves, if you like, into the ways in which we actually create our experience from moment to moment.
That was UMass Medical School Professor James Carmody speaking with WFCR's Karen Brown.